Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ashley Tellis, who's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in international security, defense, and Asian strategic issues. He was a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department, where he was intimately involved in negotiating the civil nuclear agreement with India. Previously, he served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in New Delhi and on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia. He is the author of India's Emerging Nuclear Posture and co-author of Interpreting China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present, and Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ashley Tellis.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be back.
It's good to talk to you again, Ashley. And the president did have a phone conversation with the new Prime Minister, Narendra Modi of India, who has a stunning victory, even though it's only 30% of the vote. We should keep that in context. But, of course, technically, at the time that his victory happened, Modi was still banned from getting a visa to the United States. Clearly, the phone conversation where the president invited him to come to the United States at a mutually agreeable time trumps that. But it is a little strange and perhaps even embarrassing.
It is an awkward moment for both countries because the circumstances, of course, that led up to the U.S. government revoking that visa in 2005 are now well known. They have to do with accusations about Modi's inaction during the riots that took place in Gujarat in 2002. But the fact of the matter is, at the end of the day, the United States and India have converging interests. And Mr. Modi, for all his personal grievances against the United States, is a committed Indian nationalist who I think will take his bearings from what India requires of the U.S. in the years to come. And so I think we can actually have a productive working relationship, even if he continues to nurse some grievances for a while longer.
But isn't there a fairly stark contrast between these two leaders, Obama and Modi? Obama, of course, comes out of an American liberal inclusive tradition, and Modi seems to be a rather plain-spoken nationalist, opposed to welfare and to appeasement of minorities. In other words, the nationalist versus the politically correct leader.
That is true. I mean, the differences between the two are actually quite clear and quite conspicuous. President Obama is also a deeply cerebral individual. Prime Minister-elect Modi is not. He's a man of very strong convictions, but not given to sophisticated and elaborate reasoning, at least in public. But I think at the end of the day, a certain pragmatism will come to dominate his regime in India. He recognizes the point that you made earlier on, which is he has a landslide victory in terms of the number of seats in parliament, but he has not crossed the threshold where the popular vote is concerned. And by the way, that has been true for every government in India since independence. No government has ever had a majority of the popular vote. So in that sense, he is not unique. But even so, I think he recognizes the limits of his mandate. And he has said publicly that he wants to be an inclusive prime minister representing the interests of all Indians. And I think he will actually do that because whatever else he does, he's a politician. He wants to stay in power for a long time. And he knows that the only way to making that happen is to be successful. And he cannot be successful politically if he pursues a divisive social policy.
But in terms of foreign policy, Ashley Tellis, there's an expectation that he's likely to have a more assertive foreign policy. And to my mind, I think it's very telling that one of the first people to send congratulations to India's new prime minister is the new nationalist leader of Japan, Abe, who in many ways seem to be similar. And I think a real alliance is going to develop, is it not, between India and Japan?
I think that is true. Remember, Shinzo Abe was one of the few foreign leaders who actually developed a personal relationship with Narendra Modi when he was in the wilderness. They met on several occasions, and Abe was very taken by Modi. And so I expect that simply as a matter of personal relationship as well as national strategy, Japan and India will come much closer in years to come than they've ever been in the past. But I want to address the issue of assertiveness. In some ways, an assertive Indian foreign policy may not be a bad thing, depending on what its assertiveness entails. I mean, for the last 5 years, for example, we've seen an Indian foreign policy that has been, you know, terribly rudderless and lacking direction. So if assertiveness means that we will understand clearly what the intentions of India's leadership are, then that's a good thing. If assertiveness means picking fights with India's neighbors, then that's obviously not good for us and certainly not good for India. My own sense is that Modi will be careful about how he deals with India's neighbors because of the issues of his own personal reputation. And again, because I think fights with India's neighbors distract from what he sees as his legacy issue, which is setting right the economy, going back to the phase of high growth, and in the process, you know, being seen as successful by the Indian electorate.
But on in terms of what's been happening on the American side of the U.S.-India relations, it does feel that the President Obama somewhat dropped the ball. There's no question that President Clinton was deeply engaged and was very fond of India. And I happen to know I.K. Gujral, the Prime Minister, and they had a very good relationship. And then also the Bush administration kept a vigorous engagement going. It seems like it's lapsed under Obama. Is that your impression?
I think it has in some ways. The president has certainly been distracted by a succession of crises that he's had to deal with since he took office. He, of course, had a very successful visit to India, and he actually moved the ball further. You know, he announced, despite, you know, great skepticism that he would, the U.S. support for India's candidacy to the U.N. Security Council. He completed, actually, the civil nuclear cooperation accord that was begun by his predecessor, you know, President Bush. But in recent years, and certainly in the second term, he has not paid as much personal attention to India. And it's also suffered, the relationship has also suffered because of the fact of Hillary Clinton's departure. When Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, she focused on India a great deal, in part because of her own husband's interest and her personal interest in India. I think we can put some of the pieces back together if Mr. Modi, you know, takes, you know, responds to the overtures that the president has now made. Because there is a lot that can be productively done in the next 2 years of, you know, the Obama administration's life. And certainly my advice to, you know, Mr. Modi and the people around him would be, you know, take the opportunity for everything it's worth. The U.S. has a lot to offer. But, you know, I think India has to at least take one step forward.
So, but in terms of the broader geopolitical landscape, with the idea that India could be some kind of buffer against China's growing hegemony in the neighborhood, if not the world. You know, there's obviously a lot of backlash over what is often referred to as piles of rocks in the South China Sea, with both South Korea, Japan, now very intense clashes with Vietnam and Chinese factories being burnt in Vietnam, very tense relations with the Philippines. And the idea that the new Indian Prime Minister and the Japanese Prime Minister see eye to eye, you can't escape the idea that maybe there's a deal in the works, that Japan will invest deeply in India's infrastructure, which is in desperate need of being brought up to date. And also, there'll be some kind of, do you think there'll be some kind of military alignment?
I'm not certain of that. In fact, I'm skeptical that you will see a military alignment between Japan and India. What is likely to happen is that India is going to remain more actively engaged in East and Southeast Asia. I think that is inevitable. Mr. Modi sees that as a priority for India. He sees the need to rejuvenate what used to be called the Look East policy. And he will certainly create more opportunities for investment from East Asia and Southeast Asia in India. So there will certainly be a tightening of India's relations with these two important quadrants of the world. But I think India still recognizes that it is a weak state. It does not have the power projection capabilities that could make a difference to the East Asian balance of power. And India has still got unresolved security problems in its own neighborhood, both with Pakistan and with China. And so to the degree that India can be a balancer, I think the balancing will take the form of India becoming a more capable country that provides China some reason for pause. But I don't think India is going to go beyond that in terms of creating active security agreements or active security alliances that require it to bring its power to bear in East and Southeast Asia. I think that is still a bridge too far.
But in terms of China's relationship with Pakistan, there is, of course, that in itself was generated out of a geopolitical clash with India, was it not?
That is absolutely true. But you've seen in the last two decades an interesting turn of events. The Chinese-Pakistan relationship has by no means diminished. But the Sino-Indian relationship, especially in the economic arena, has really grown gangbusters. And so what you find is that the Indians now face the same dilemma with China that the United States has. They are deeply concerned about the rise of Chinese power. They are actually threatened by the rise of Chinese power. But they are also economically intertwined with China in ways that are extremely significant. Today, China is India's largest merchandise trading partner. And so that automatically imposes some limits on the kinds of strategies that India can pursue. It no longer has the luxury of a pure balancing strategy against China. It has to couple the balancing, which it will certainly indulge in, with some degree of engagement. And from a Chinese point of view, I think the same is true as well. India, for them, is a place where they make a lot of money. And so they have to make a judgment about how far they're going to go in support of Pakistan, while holding at risk what is an economically lucrative relationship with New Delhi.
But clearly things are likely to get more tense in Pakistan with the withdrawal of the US, and Pakistan has put itself in a dilemma in as much as it has basically created the Taliban. And now if the Taliban is unleashed and takes over, or there's a civil war and a bloody stalemate, Pakistan itself is in danger of reverse sanctuary, where the Taliban, in effect, use Afghanistan as a sanctuary, and then in order to attack Pakistan. So they've sort of, to some extent, that government's reaping the whirlwind. At least the military and the ISI are reaping the whirlwind of their strategy throughout this whole agonizing American experience in Afghanistan. That is certainly not going to end with a stable Afghanistan.
I think you are absolutely correct. And from a Pakistani point of view, it must be, you know, terribly ironic that their success, or at least the strategy that they pursued, which was to make the life of the United States somewhat difficult in the last 15-odd years, has now come to fruition in the worst possible way. They've got the United States out of Afghanistan, which was, you know, their strategic objective early on. And now they find themselves in a position where the forces that they've unleashed are essentially the same forces that threaten them. Unfortunately, this is not something that China can help resolve. Pakistan has to make some strategic decisions about its own national trajectory. And thus far, unfortunately, the decisions it has made are, you know, still very, very compromised and very, very diffident.
But we know that this government and the military in Pakistan are very paranoid about India's intentions in Afghanistan, and they've overblown them. So if you have a more assertive, even aggressive Indian prime minister and a more paranoid India, who already convinced that India is playing games inside of Afghanistan, isn't that a recipe for, if not disaster, more tension?
It would be. If the scenario unfolds in exactly the way you described, that to me is essentially the worst case scenario that one can imagine. And in those circumstances, of course, we would see a very poisoned India-Pakistan relationship beyond what it already is. And, you know, some probability that the two countries would actually come to blows in different ways, whether it be in Afghanistan or bilaterally between themselves. But I think the near-term scenario is somewhat different. The near-term scenario, at least for the next year where Mr. Modi is concerned, my sense is that the policy he will adopt is essentially one of strategic indifference, where until he is convinced that Pakistan is willing to deal with those terrorist groups that directly threaten India, and here groups like Lashkar-e-Taiba come to mind, he will not make extraordinary efforts to reach out to Pakistan. And of course, that creates different kinds of problems, because a Pakistan that feels ignored, a Pakistan that feels it's at the receiving end of Indian indifference, can choose to do crazy things to get New Delhi's attention. And that is something that, of course, we have to be alert to. But I think that is the real fear, at least in the near term. And what happens, of course, post-2014 is anyone's guess at this point. But the scenario that you laid out is one that all parties have to think very seriously about.
But just in closing, if Modi, his nationalist instincts create a disquiet and nervousness amongst India's large Muslim minority, any incidents in that neighborhood would affect the relationship with Pakistan, because, you know, what people forget is that India's Muslim minority are very loyal to India, but if they have a prime minister who is hostile to them, perhaps that could change that equation.
And I think that is right as well, which is why the biggest unfinished business coming out of this election for him has to be proving that he is going to be inclusive in his policies and that he is genuinely going to represent the interests of all India's diverse peoples and not simply that section of the electorate that brought him into power. That is really his unfinished business. And, you know, we will have to see in the next few months how he proceeds to address this.
Well, Ashley Tellis, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Ashley Tellis, who is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, specializing in international security, defense, and Asian strategic issues. He was a senior advisor to the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs at the State Department, where he was intimately involved in negotiating the civil nuclear agreement with India. Previously, he served as senior advisor to the ambassador at the United States Embassy in New Delhi and on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the president and senior director for strategic planning and Southwest Asia. He's the author of India's Emerging Nuclear Posture and co-author of Interpreting China's Grand Strategy, Past, Present, and Future. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the man who is India's new prime minister.